At the Democratic National Convention, Senator Ted Kennedy gave a rousing speech, his first since surgery to remove a brain tumor.
And I pledge to you that I will be there next January on the floor of the United States Senate when we begin the great fight.
It was a night of big speeches. Michelle Obama also took to the podium. Emotional pleas for unity among the Democrats. Today is day two of the Democratic Convention. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 26th. John Hockenberry is away. Michelle Obama took center stage in Denver. We'll go there with a live report. Also there, Senator Hillary Clinton's delegates try to convince her supporters to vote for Obama. And today, what does ex-FEMA director Michael Brown think about his role in Hurricane Katrina rescue efforts 3 years later? Those stories and more. But first, Femi Oke is here with the headlines. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning, all. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has announced that Russia is officially recognizing the independence of the breakaway Georgian regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. The Russian parliament voted unanimously on a measure yesterday, and President Medvedev signed the decree this morning. The Democratic National Convention kicked off last night in Denver. Michelle Obama took the stage for a keynote speech that emphasized Barack Obama's ordinary American roots.
He was raised by grandparents who were working class folks just like my parents, and by a single mother who struggled to pay the bills just like we did.
Michelle Obama focused on family in her speech, and she wasn't the only one. Senator Ted Kennedy made an appearance even though he's battling cancer.
Our country will be committed to his cause. The work begins anew. The hope rises again, and the dream lives on.
Kennedy compared Barack Obama's vision to that of his brother, John F. Kennedy. Hillary Clinton will give her speech tonight. North Korea says it has stopped disabling its nuclear facilities and may even start restoring them. A foreign ministry spokesman says that the move is payback for the White House's refusal to take North Korea off the U.S. list of terror sponsors. Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he's reviewing whether U.S. and NATO troops should stay in his country. Tensions are rising over civilian casualties. Afghan officials say that almost 100 people were killed in airstrikes just over the weekend. And the White House says it's investigating the incident, but maintains the clashes killed only 5 civilians. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is meeting with both Israeli and Palestinian leaders today as she continues her Middle East trip. The White House is still aiming for a peace deal before the year's end, but Rice is playing down hopes that negotiations will make progress anytime soon. Oil dropped below $113 a barrel. The Dow plunged yesterday more than 2% to 11,386. And the S&P dropped almost 2%. It's set to open at 1266. Adora.
Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And Barack and I were raised with so many of the same values, like you work hard for what you want in life, that your word is your bond, that you do what you say you're going to do, that you treat people with dignity and respect, even if you don't know them and even if you don't agree with them.
It was an historic night at the Democratic National Convention. Michelle Obama, the country's first potential African-American First Lady, took center stage. She was there to not only tell the audience of Democrats, as well as members of the United States and voters, more about herself, but also to share the Barack Obama she knows as husband and father. And adding to the emotion, Senator Ted Kennedy made his first speech since having surgery and treatment for a brain tumor. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein, she is there in Denver bringing us reports all this week from the convention. She joins us now. And good morning, Andrea. It was certainly a high-charged evening.
Good morning. Yes, it was. And obviously, especially when Kennedy came out. I mean, there was a message of the night. The message was, the Obama family is just like your family. And we'll get back to that in the moment. But that theme was punctuated by this moment when Ted Kennedy walks out on stage, and we didn't know for sure that he was going to come out. There was a Kennedy family video, and it was, you know, all of the Kennedys, and there had been reports that Ted Kennedy was sick and or hadn't been feeling well because of his flight out, and then he comes out on the stage, and there's just pandemonium, and this is, after all, probably the last time a Kennedy of his generation will ever address a Democratic convention, and that point was brought home by this quote.
And I pledge to you that I will be there next January on the floor of the United States Senate when we begin the great talk.
So you can see, I mean, he couldn't even get through the sentence, but the emotional pitch remained high through his entire speech. And I was standing with the Massachusetts delegation, and they were just overcome with emotion as he wrapped up his speech. I mean, people literally couldn't talk except to say that they really were believing what he said, that he would be there in January, because, of course, he is very sick with brain cancer.
And there were actually some people in the audience who were wiping away tears.
You know, this is the kind of thing that happens at a Democratic convention. And, you know, I should mention that, you know, not people watch the speeches and they see the, you know, highlights, but, you know, a lot of what happens also at the convention is sort of what happened between Kennedy and the next big speaker of the night, which was Michelle Obama, which is especially on the Monday night when people are arriving, because people are seeing each other for the first time. Maybe they're people they haven't seen in 4 years, and everybody is hugging and kissing and chatting and schmoozing and not paying so much attention to the speakers. So during this period between Kennedy and Michelle Obama, I was walking around and I was talking to people about the Obama campaign, and there was this palpable sense of anxiety, both about how, you know, Michelle Obama was going to do and whether she was going to land her punch, but also just about the campaign. And people were feeling it isn't where they thought it was going to be 2 months ago. It is neck and neck, according to the latest polls, a dead heat. And Democrats coming out of the primary thought that everything was on their side. They were going to win it. And here they are, and they are having to introduce the Obama family to the nation and make their case in a way they did not expect.
And he's the same man who drove me and our new baby daughter home from the hospital 10 years ago this summer, inching along at a snail's pace, peering at us anxiously through the rearview mirror, feeling the whole weight of her future in his hands, determined to give her everything he'd struggled so hard for himself, determined to give her something he never had. The affirming embrace of a father's love.
So that was Michelle Obama. And, you know, as she had been giving her speech, I mean, she was standing there at the podium. She's very tall, and she's almost 6 feet tall. She was wearing this green dress, and she was standing there. I was sort of off at the side so I could, you know, really get a good view of her. She was standing with her palms up, almost as if she was beseeching the crowd. And it wasn't until that quote that you just heard where this sort of jolt went through the crowd. I mean, she had been talking about her family life in Chicago, about her upbringing, about when she met Barack Obama. And then she talks about this sense of sort of his wanting to be a good father and his nervousness for the country. And that is the moment where everybody stood up and they began to pay attention. And then she wraps it all up at this moment at the end of the speech, mm-hmm. where she says, this is what happens. You know, this is what we want to be able to tell all children when they are tucked to bed at night.
They'll tell them how this time we listen to our hopes instead of our fears. how this time we decided to stop doubting and to start dreaming. How this time, in this great country where a girl from the south side of Chicago can go to college and law school, and the son of a single mother from Hawaii can go all the way to the White House.
So that was how she wrapped up. And I mean, by then people were crying, and it was sort of tears of emotion and tears of relief that, you know, she had managed to establish this connection, this sort of universal parent connection with America, that, you know, we are doing this because we care for our children. We care for the next generation.
And speaking of that, there was actually a little bonanza at the end of her speech that it was a little unexpected, but some people thought staged and others thought not.
Well, it's kind of funny because what happened is his two daughters, Sasha and Malia, came out on stage and they're waving to the crowd. And, you know, that might have been the end of it. And then up pops Barack Obama's face on the big video and everybody starts to cheer. He's in some kind of hotel room in Kansas City, Missouri. And he says, "Hello, Michelle." And he starts to praise Michelle. And he starts to make the point, and you're going to hear it in just a second in the clip we're going to play. He starts to make the point that the family he's with from Missouri is just like us. Get it? That's the theme of the night, just like us. But guess what happens? Sasha jumps in and cuts him off, and he never gets to make the point. And here she is.
Hey, Michelle.
Hi, Daddy.
You were unbelievable. And
you
also look very cute.
Thank you.
That's Sasha.
And listen, I'm here with the Gerardo family here in St. Louis. This is Jim and Alicia, and like us,
hi, Gerardo,
they've got
family.
Daughters.
And that pretty much ended it. Whatever point Barack Obama
was trying to get it out, but she was not going to let him get that out.
But, you know, I mean, it was funny because it was sort of an unscripted moment in this scripted moment, but it couldn't have been better if they had scripted it because she created this sense of reality about
the
Barack
Obama
family.
Yeah, which is children sometimes don't let their parents speak, even if your parent has to be running for president.
So it was this incredible sort of conclusion to the night, and then everybody exhaled. They're like, okay, day one, we did what we needed to do.
And let's talk about how they're going to build on that today as we look forward. But I want to ask you a quick question. This came from one of our listeners. He writes on our website, since the precedent has been set for the wife of an ex-president running for the office of president herself, I think the first woman president of the United States will be Michelle Obama. When are we going to bring that into the conversation? Dennis, we just did. What do you think, Andrea?
Well, Michelle Obama is not a public speaker. And one of the things about her, I mean, she is a public speaker. She's a known person, but not on the national political stage. And one of the things that really happened last night is this was her real introduction to America as a speaker and as a person. But she's not someone like Hillary Clinton, who was seen for quite a long time to have political ambitions of her own, unlike Barack Obama. So she was really sort of there to kind of deliver the punch for him not to run for office herself.
And quickly, how do you think the Barack campaign is now going to try to build on the Ted Kennedy speech, the Michelle Obama speech today?
Well, I spoke to the number of people in the Barack Obama campaign yesterday, and there still is a lot of anxiety, but there is a feeling as this convention goes on and as the campaign goes on, they're going to be drawing lots of sharp contrasts between John McCain and Barack Obama. We heard some of that last night. I think we'll be hearing more and more of it as the week goes on, because they really want to get those people who are feeling, mm-hmm. well, I want change, but I feel kind of comfortable with John McCain, to feel uncomfortable with John McCain. That's their task for the rest of the week.
Andrea Bernstein, thank you.
Thank you.
Look out for Andrea Bernstein and the Takeaway political folks who are down there covering, or up there, I should say, in Denver covering the convention on our website at thetakeaway.org, and listen for them on the show. Andrea Bernstein, our Takeaway political director, reporting from Denver.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 26th. John Hockenberry is away. As we march toward the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina this week, we're taking a look at how things are today in the Gulf and also taking a look back at what happened that week. In all, the storm killed 1,200 people along the Gulf Coast, flooded New Orleans, and forced the evacuation of tens of thousands of people. At the center of the government's response was Michael Brown, back then the director of FEMA. He joins us from Atlanta. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Adora.
So what did you learn from Hurricane Katrina?
Well, unfortunately, all of the things that I had kind of been screaming within the Department of Homeland Security about the marginalization of FEMA, its budget cuts, the kind of diminution of its mission, were all coming true. And you couple that with the problems that we had with state and local governments, it was a disaster within a disaster.
And for the most part, fairly or unfairly, you've become a real symbol of everything that went wrong, all those things that you just mentioned. Where do you think the buck does stop?
Well, the buck really stops with the president and it stops with Secretary Chertoff. I mean, Secretary Chertoff really became an impediment to the response process. The commander in the field at the time, which was myself, has to have full reign of authority to make the decisions, to move things where they had to be moved, to make the decisions in the field based upon the information that's actually in the field. And when Secretary Chertoff ordered me to go back to Baton Rouge and try to run a disaster that covers 90,000 square miles from behind a desk, it was just doomed to fail.
I think that's hard for many people to understand. At least you're not taking some responsibility, given the fact that you were the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Oh, Adora, let me make perfectly clear. I have said in numerous public speeches around the world and throughout this country that I take responsibility for those mistakes that I made. And that primary mistake that I made was at the very beginning when things weren't working and when I could see that the systems were beginning to break down. Then what I should have done was, instead of, you know, you stand up in the podium with the politicians around you and everyone has their arms around each other talking about, you know, what a great job everyone's doing, I should have spoken the absolute truth at that point and told the American public that this disaster and this system was not working and that we needed their patience and to basically, to wake up the administration to what needed to be done. Now, in hindsight, probably been fired on the spot for having said those things publicly, but it would have been the exact right thing to have done.
You spend your professional life now advising people on emergency responses. What do you tell them based on the experiences that you've had and what you just mentioned, that sometimes you've got to say when it's not working, you have to say it loudly?
Well, Adora, it's amazing the response that I get from executives, CEOs, and particularly response and emergency agencies around the world, who look at me and say, who better to learn this from, because he's seen how it works from, you know, the events of 9/11 to the hurricanes in 2004 and 160 other disasters, to the guy who's been in the bottom of the pit where it's just completely fallen apart and not working, not worked. So who better to learn those lessons from than from the guy who's seen the entire spectrum of what works and what doesn't work?
Give us one single piece of advice that you think is important today.
That you have to understand that at some point, whether you're a CEO, you're a government bureaucrat, whatever you happen to be, that when your world around you begins to crumble and all of the things that you think are supposed to work don't work, that the smartest thing that you can do is to immediately just say stop admit to your consumers, your shareholders, whoever they are, that things are not working, and here are the steps that we're going to proactively take to make this thing work and turn it around. See, I often think that what we don't do is we don't give the American public enough credit. The American public just wants to know the truth. What's really going on, what's really happening, whether it's good or bad, they can accept that.
And I think that, just to interrupt you right there, I think that's a really important point that you're making, because I covered Hurricane Katrina. In fact, I was at several of the news conferences that you did with Chertoff several days after Hurricane Katrina, and there certainly was a real lack of urgency, and there was a real lack of honesty about what was actually happening on the ground in New Orleans in terms of troops getting there, in terms of food and water getting there.
Right, because the politicians, and myself included.
No, but I'm actually speaking about you specifically, with all due respect.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, and particularly me. So when you stand up and you say, you use those talking points and you try to put the rosy picture on, it creates a disconnect. It creates a disconnect between the spokesperson, myself, and the media.
Mm-hmm.
A disconnect between the media and what's really happening. A disconnect between me and the general public. And the more you have those disconnects, the more cynical everyone becomes, and the more difficult it makes it to say, here's what's happening, here's what we need. In the case of a public event like Katrina,
mm-hmm.
it makes it even more difficult to rally, for example, the cabinet, so that the cabinet understands that when Michael Brown says he needs X, I better get off my butt and get those things to him.
Have you been to New Orleans recently?
I was in Baton Rouge. There's the Stevenson Disaster Management Institute that was established at Louisiana State University. And they've had me down to speak to their crisis management group about what they can do better next time.
That's Michael Brown, former FEMA director during Hurricane Katrina, now owner of Michael Brown Consulting International. Now it's time for some headlines from Femi Oke. Hey there, Femi.
Hi there to you, Adora. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Russia has officially recognized the independence of the breakaway Georgian regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev made the announcement in a televised address today. Russian troops are still inside Georgia proper, beyond the borders of the separatist territories. The Democratic National Convention kicked off last night in Denver. Both Michelle Obama and Senator Ted Kennedy gave speeches. But tonight, all eyes will be on Hillary Clinton. She takes the stage for a much-anticipated speech that will focus on party unity. North Korea is halting any moves to disable its nuclear capabilities and may, in fact, restart activity at its nuclear facilities. Pyongyang says the move is a response to Washington's failure to move the country off the list of countries that sponsor terrorism. In Pakistan this morning, gunmen let loose a hail of bullets on a vehicle carrying the top U.S. diplomat in the country. Lynn Tracy's car came under fire in Peshawar, the main city in Pakistan's volatile northwest. Tracy's driver took evasive action and nobody was injured in the attack. And finally, Hurricane Gustave is picking up speed and barreling towards Haiti. And forecasters say the storm could be a Category 2 with winds of almost 100 miles an hour by the time it makes landfall later on today. And that is a look at your news. I'm just giving Dora a little bit of time because she's eating a banana.
Thanks for sharing that.
Just a little.
Thanks for sharing
that. It's good. It's good that you're keeping your strength
up. But poor
up.
Haiti. They really got the brunt of some of the earlier storms this year so far, and now you got another one heading their way.
Yep.
Thanks,
the ocean's
Femi.
Warming up. We're into hurricane season, good and proper.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Tuesday, August 26th. And we're taking a look at disposable fashion today. In the world of fashion, is it true what you get you get what you pay for, and some argue that clothing chains like H&M or Forever 21 are essentially creating a culture of irresponsible waste. What do you think? Can you be fashionable without filling the landfill? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Also today and all this week, we're covering the Democratic Convention from many angles, not only about how the delegates and the party activists feel, but also about how they feel about voters. The Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein, spent last week traveling through the swing states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Missouri, and she met many Hillary Clinton supporters who are now torn. This one lifelong Democrat is thinking of crossing the aisle.
Do you think that there's a difference between Barack Obama and John McCain on the issues?
Oh, yeah, there's a difference between the two on issues.
So it just, that doesn't make you want to go out and vote for Obama, even though you voted Democrat in the primary?
No, absolutely not.
You're not doing it?
No.
Andrea is at the convention in Denver all week for us at The Takeaway, and she's been asking Hillary Clinton about these voter concerns. Good morning, Andrea. What'd you find out?
Good morning. Well, yesterday morning, Hillary Clinton sort of made her debut at the Democratic Convention with a speech to the New York delegation about unity. And she was pretty clear in saying that she wanted people to vote for Barack Obama. She said she was tired of screaming at her TV screen. She didn't want to do it anymore. And she wanted to elect a Democrat president. Afterwards, she had a press conference, and I asked her about those Ohio voters because she said, I'm going to keep urging people to vote for Obama. And I said, well, what are you going to do to the people like this fellow Jerry Roth from Ohio who just won't listen to you? And she said, well, I'm not sure what I can do. I'm just going to keep doing everything I possibly can and to continue to make the contrast between the two candidates.
For people who voted for me, as I have said and will repeat until the last votes are counted, if you voted for me, you have much more in common with Senator Obama on every issue I campaigned on every cause that I have stood for, than you do with Senator McCain.
So, Andrea, what is she saying now about her delegates, her very many delegates?
Well, there is some confusion. After that press conference, one of the superdelegates actually came up and asked me, what is Hillary Clinton telling us to do? She will be addressing them tomorrow at a meeting afternoon, and she will be saying, she was pretty clear that she wants to go ahead and have this roll call vote, and she laid it out.
I think that we'll have a meeting with my delegates. It's the first time I will have had a chance to see them on Wednesday. And at that time, I will be formally releasing them. They know that already. They're reading what you're writing. And telling them that I intend to vote for Senator Obama. A lot of people are committed to unifying behind Senator Obama. How they vote is a more personal decision.
And she went on to say that some people feel that they were elected to come and vote for her, and some people just wanted to do it. She said this is what you do at conventions, but then she said everyone will go and will be supporting Obama in the presidential race in the fall.
Andrea, what did she mean, do you think, about voting is a more personal decision, more personal than if you're a party activist backing the party nominee?
Well, what she was indicating was that she wasn't going to tell the delegates exactly what to do. If they want to go and vote for her on a roll call vote because they feel they're obligated or because that's their desire, so be it. But then they needed to turn around and support Barack Obama. And she was pretty clear that she was going to go out and work hard. And I've been speaking to some of her top aides, and they say she has a full schedule in the fall in the swing states. She made the point at the press conference that she's probably done more already than most losing candidates in a similar position in history. So she was not equivocal in her support for Obama. I mean, she's probably less equivocal than some of her supporters who are still feeling ambivalent, are still feeling torn. Tonight, when Hillary Clinton takes the stage...
Right, I was just going to ask you, what can we expect, do you think, at her primetime speech tonight?
Well, I think that we should expect more of this, more of you should go out and support Obama. The differences between Obama and McCain couldn't be clearer. And if you support me, you should support him. But it's impossible to imagine there won't be this moment of what if, what might have been, which has been sort of an undercurrent here in Denver this entire convention so far.
Okay, well, Hillary Clinton, still very important to whatever happens come November.
Such a big figure, such a big figure in the Democratic Party. And it's not surprising. She campaigned in 50 states and I think four territories. So pretty much everybody here has had their chance to come into contact with Hillary Clinton. It's not surprising that there is this intensity of feeling. But she's going to say, go put that all into the general election campaign.
And Bill Clinton, he's around, right?
Bill Clinton, I have not yet seen him. I understand that Chelsea Clinton has arrived here in Denver, but Bill Clinton will be speaking on Wednesday night, same night as Joe Biden, and he may upstage the vice presidential candidate. He's quite a formidable speaker himself. This will be the first time where Bill Clinton will be, or at least will be supposed to be, making a full-throated endorsement of Barack Obama. We'll be watching for that tomorrow night.
Andrea Bernstein is the Takeaway political director. She'll be reporting from the Democratic National Convention all week as part of our continuing coverage. You can also check out her blog at thetakeaway.org. And now we're heading to Femi Okeh. He's got some headlines for us. Hey, Femi.
Thanks, Adora. Coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has recognized the independence of two breakaway regions in the Republic of Georgia. His announcement is sure to heighten tensions within the U.S. Medvedev's decree comes as a U.S. Navy warship heads towards Georgia's flashpoint city of Poti to deliver food aid. Afghan President Hamid Karzai's government will review the presence of U.S. and NATO troops in their country. That decision comes after 90 civilians died in a weekend clash and airstrikes in western Afghanistan. In Zimbabwe, Parliament has opened and President Robert Mugabe finds his ZANU-PF party in the minority for the first time in its history. The opposition Movement for Democratic Change does not recognize Mugabe as president and is boycotting opening day. Fresh back from the Olympics, American tennis player James Blake has opened in the US Open, and also moving forward is Spain's Rafael Nadal, who captured the gold in Beijing. And while we're on the subject of the Olympics, a bit of a post-mortem is going on for some countries who didn't do as well as they'd hoped. Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd is considering using extra lottery money to boost the medal count at their next Olympics. They got 6 on the medal table overall. So they had 46 medals, 9 and 14 golds. But I think the real problem was that they actually came behind the UK for the first time in 20 years. And Brazil, which is a very fit, healthy, great-looking nation. The Brazil's president... sorry.
Great-looking.
Just thinking of an old boyfriend of mine. They're also going to do better too.
Thanks, Mary.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji. John Hockenberry is away. All week, we're taking a look at Hurricane Katrina as the third anniversary approaches. We're taking a look back and taking a look at where things stand today. Today, FEMA is still housing 22,000 families throughout the Gulf Coast, and tens of thousands more are homeless in Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. Despite billions of dollars in federal aid, many say there's a disconnect in the trickle-down of affordable housing and jobs for the working poor. Sharon Hanshaw is a lifelong Biloxi, Mississippi resident who lost her rental apartment in Katrina and lived in a FEMA trailer for over 2.5 years. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Describe your circumstances today.
I'm actively trying to help myself and others retrieve the funds that we need to just exist, to live in our community. It's been very difficult because the resources didn't reach to the grassroots people. And so we're collectively, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, going to our legislators and making sure that they understand that there's been a lot of work done, but there's a lot of work still to be done.
Now, you've formed Coastal Women for Change, and the headquarters is your hair salon, right?
Yes, that was my business before I lost everything, yes.
Where are you living, and how are you organizing your friends and neighbors?
Okay, I was fortunate enough I purchased another place to live right now at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we're organizing is through my truck. We don't have an office right now because of the circumstances, so we're just like, the office is in the truck.
The office is in the truck. How are you?
Yes.
How are your friends and family members? How are they doing? Where are they living? How are they working?
Most of them are working two jobs because the living wage is not enough money to pay for rental or even rent a house or even try to purchase a home because of the living wage in Mississippi and because of the rise in the rental.
Because
after Hurricane Katrina, everything went up. Housing went up. Price of living went up. I can't even tell you about the gas situation.
What signs, if any, are you seeing are rebuilding as you walk around the streets of your neighborhood? Describe them to us.
Okay. In my community, you see a few affordable housing that's existing, that's coming up, but it's just not enough in my community. You'll see a little growth coming up because, like I say, there's work that's being done. It's just not enough because in the community, half of the community is not back home. They're still displaced. But if you go to the front end, you will see the casinos, condominiums, and developers are rising. So if you go in the front end, you'll be like, oh, Mississippi, they're doing pretty good because the lights are on and it's really bright and the casinos are live and working. But when you go to the backflash of the community, it's not the same.
So enough hasn't been done. Sharon Hanshaw, we thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you well.
Thank you so much.
Sharon Hanshaw is a single mom and a local activist from Biloxi, Mississippi, who herself was living in a trailer until just 3 months ago, and now she's working with others to help rebuild her community.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have the very latest headlines for you from Femi Oke. Femi?
Thanks, Adore. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Senator Ted Kennedy and Michelle Obama kicked off the Democratic National Convention last night. Kennedy focused on the theme of change, while Michelle Obama spoke about family values. 77 million Americans have no health insurance, and they will spend $30 billion out of pocket on health care this year. That's according to two new studies by the U.S. Census Bureau. The Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, is in the Middle East, where she will meet with Israeli and Palestinian leaders today. Rice is in the region as part of a U.S. effort to secure peace deals by the end of this year. Hurricane Gustave is barreling towards Haiti with winds nearly at 80 miles an hour, and forecasters say the storm will also hit Cuba. And finally, Warner Brothers is suing an Indian film company about the title of a new film. The movie is in Hindi and it's called Hariputta, a comedy of terrors. Here's a sneak preview.
Hariputta, a comedy of terrors. Do not dare me do this. Coming soon to a theater near you.
Well, Warner Brothers says that the name is far too close to Harry Potter, but Hari is a popular Indian name and Putta means son in Punjabi. It's the story of a 10-year-old little boy who moves to England and gets caught in the search for a microchip. So, Adora is our legal eagle. Harry Putta, is that too close to Harry Potter, do you think?
I think it all depends on how you pronounce it, actually. The way you pronounce it, it might be.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that it's all going to be in the beholder of the ears and how it's technically supposed to be. pronounced. And it doesn't sound too close, though, to be honest with you.
Yeah. It opens the September.
A magical
the 12th.
Child and a boy who experiences life in a different culture. It doesn't sound exactly
the same. No, it's a different the storyline from what I can gather from the little bit that I've watched in Hindi sounds very different from Harry Potter that we know and love.
From the little that you've watched in Hindi?
Yes. Harry? Yeah. I want you to know that I take my research on this show extremely seriously. The film opens September the 12th in Hindi. If you need help, call me. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We're taking a look at disposable fashion today, or what some people consider disposable fashion. Is it true you get what you pay for? Can being fashionable mean that you're contributing to the landfill? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. Sarah on our website says the whole point of stores like Forever 21 is that they are explicitly marketing fashion that changes every 2 or 3 months at rock bottom prices and quality, with the goal of shoppers buying new clothes and throwing away the old. Why not? They're so cheap. Well, the Britain's House of Lords, they certainly, House of Lords, have an opinion about this. They've called it fast fashion. They think that companies are being encouraged to create what's in today and out the next. So they are concerned about the sustainability, about the impact on the environment. Mary Beth Williams is the Takeaway's own personal shopper for today, our culture reporter. She joins us now. So what exactly, what are the British House of Lords, what are they talking about?
Well, it's interesting. What's interesting about this is it comes from the House of Lords Select Committee on Science and Technology. That's not necessarily what I pick up first for my fashion advice, but it's been a real lightning rod in the fashion community and all over the blogosphere. And I think that what they're getting at is actually a very valid point, which is if we take away the kind of the finger-wagging aspect of it, speaking as someone who did her kids' back-to-school shopping yesterday at Target myself, what we get down to is this concept of, you know, maybe we do need to be a little more mindful of the way that we spend our money on clothes. And that doesn't have to be guilt-trippy, but in the way that we think about, okay, do I need a plastic bag to go to the supermarket, or can I bring my own? Do I know where my food came from? I mean, this is something that's been in our consciousness over the last few years. We're going to start seeing this in fashion as well. We're going to start seeing it in clothing as well. Where did that $5 shirt come from? What's its provenance? Do I need it? That kind of thing. Because you go into a Forever 21 or you go into an H&M, and it's every week there's a glut of new merchandise. There's a glut of it.
What do you think, what triggered any of this? Was there some particular concern with waste? Is there some growing evidence that people are more wasteful in the UK today versus 5 or 10 or 15 years ago? And everyone can't afford to go to the very high-end stores to buy clothing.
God knows I can't.
H&M and Forever 21 are reasonably priced clothes that many people can afford. So
absolutely.
What's the point here?
I think the point is just the idea that, you know, we have kind of reached this tipping point with quality as well. A lot of, a lot of the big retailers, because of this demand for more and more and newer retailers are posting losses. The July retail reports were all down. So how are retailers going to get customers in the store? And the traditional wisdom in the past has been throw it all against the wall, see what sticks, bring in new merchandise every week and hope that the consumers come back. And what I think is going to happen, what consumers are going to start saying is, in the same way that we've been doing with food, no, what we want instead is to feel like when we come into the store, we're in a dialogue with the retailers and they're going to be responsible. We're going to know where our clothes come from. I mean, I talked to somebody from Target, a representative from Target yesterday, and he gave me the example of their own in-store brands. Now, they're not going to be using PVCs. Which is the plastics. A form of, and what that means is they're no longer bundling their socks in plastic. They're now wrapping them in cardboard. And the customers like that because now they can touch the socks. The
this
bottom line
seems
is this
like
is,
a very odd way to get to some notions of how we become better and more responsible consumers. Because actually, if you're saying sales numbers are down, then that negates everything that they're talking about. If people are buying less, then what would be the reason to ban fast fashion.
Well, it's not a ban. I mean, nobody's going to ban anything. And, I mean, there has been talk about boycotting. But what we're saying instead is, yeah, sales are down. And this notion that bringing in more and more and newer and cheaper and less quality is not working. It's simply not working. It's not sustainable for the retailers and it's not sustainable for consumers. Like I said, I've got kids. I buy the $10 pants. I believe in all of that, too. That's what I need. But what we're going to start having to do is really think a little bit more in terms of what that means in terms of landfill, what that means in terms of who made those clothes. You know, I'm wearing a skirt right now that was made in Bangladesh, and I need to think about, well, where did that come from? And it's just a case of mindfulness. It's not something that's going to happen this fall with your wardrobe,
right.
But we are going to be seeing over the next few years, people are going to have to start asking these questions in terms of sustainability for workers and for the environment.
But that sort of applies to all products, doesn't it? Because so many of the products are made in the same places, whether you're going to a luxury store
right.
and spending thousands and thousands of dollars on a suit or going to H&M and spending $100 on
a suit. Sure, the idea that your $800 shoes have any less of a carbon footprint than your $5
right.
t-shirt
I guess
is kind of ridiculous,
too. It seems
too.
Rather classist, I think some might say.
That's entirely possible. The British House of Lords.
Who
is more classist than the British House of Lords? And I don't think anybody should be guilt tripping us about our choices, especially when when we've just heard this report about how many of us don't even have health insurance. And that's completely valid for us to do whatever we have to do to put our kids in pants for school. But also, in terms of long-term sustainability, we have to be thinking in terms of the long-term as well as what we're going to wear this fall. And that means making choices that are just a little bit more mindful. And the same way that we've been doing, as you said, with everything, with what our clothes are made of, with the way that they're packaged, with the way that we spend our money. And if it's a choice between, buying the $10 pants or buying something that's maybe $1 more, but is made in a different way.
I was going to say, yeah, because that's the trick, isn't it? Because especially families today, I mean, the economy is tough for so many. So the idea that they would spend more money
right.
to put clothes on their children who grow every year when they're young.
I can't
do it. And
they
need new pants right. and new shirts. So it's kind of a bind of what do you do?
Right. And that's, that's not something that's going to get solved, before school starts next week. Not for me.
Certainly not. Well, Mary Beth Williams, many thanks for your report to us.
Thanks.
Mary Beth Williams, our takeaway personal shopper, at least for today, and our cultural eagle, keeping an eye on what's happening in the world for us. And we're coming to an end now. We've been asking people, what about this fast fashion? And Paula writes on our site, yay team, having just lived through back to school, eighth grade shopping for my daughter. I know this is an important topic. Big crisis that she has to use the same L.L. Bean backpack as the past 2 years. Things are expensive. And Rick on our website says, each year the fashion industry works hard to convince hobby shoppers, teens and women, to toss away perfectly usable products in favor of this year's glitz. Thus, women complain of a lack of closet space for the 80% of old, more than 1 year old, according to Rick, outfits they don't wear. And mothers complain of the cost of replacing last year's still usable outfits for their budding fashionistas. Many opinions on this. Please give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Today in Thailand, a bit of chaos. A mob of protesters has pushed their way into the offices of Thailand's prime minister and shut down parts of the government. But these are protests against democracy in a nation where people think Western-style governments have only brought them corruption. Rallying for non-representative rule. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 26th. John Hockenberry is away. Michelle Obama told a cheering crowd at the Democratic convention that her husband will finally bring the change we need. Democrats also heard from Senator Ted Kennedy. Coming up, we'll listen in to those speeches. Also, how much can scans of the brain tell us about our minds? There's now a backlash in the scientific community over how much the splotchy images tell us about our behavior. Those stories and more, but first, headlines with Femi Okay. Femi?
Thank you very much, Adora. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev appeared on national television just a few hours ago with this announcement.
I've signed the decrees on the recognition by the Russian Federation of the independence of South Ossetia and the independence of Abkhazia. Russia is calling on the other states to follow its example.
The move comes on the heels of yesterday's unanimous yes vote in the Russian parliament to recognize independence for the separatist regions. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is calling the decision regrettable, but residents inside the breakaway zones are celebrating today. The Democratic National Convention kicked off in Denver, Colorado last night. Michelle Obama took to the stage for the keynote speech. She focused on Barack Obama's American roots and her own rise from humble beginnings.
My piece of the American dream is a blessing hard won by those who came before me.
Senator Ted Kennedy also gave a speech full of praise for Obama. But tonight, all eyes will be on Hillary Clinton. She's addressing the convention this evening. North Korea says it may restart its nuclear program. The foreign minister says that Pyongyang has stopped its efforts to disable its nuclear facilities. North Korea says it's angry over Washington's failure to remove the country from the U.S. list of terror sponsors. Afghan President Hamid Karzai says that he's reviewing whether U.S. and NATO troops should stay in the country. There's a growing resentment in Afghanistan over civilian casualties. Afghan officials say that almost 100 civilians were killed in clashes and airstrikes this weekend alone. And the White House says it's investigating, but maintains only 5 civilians died. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is meeting with both Israeli and Palestinian leaders and hopes are fading that the two sides will reach a peace deal before the end of the year. Markets due to open in just a few minutes' time. Oil has dropped below $113 a barrel. The Dow dropped yesterday more than 2% to 11,386. And the S&P set to open at 1266. Adora.
Many thanks, Femi. And we're talking about undecided voters today. Gee, I wonder why. It's convention week this week and next week. About 10% of voters still don't know who they plan to vote for, so we want to give them some advice, or better yet, we want you to give them some advice. How do you make these tough decisions? How should they? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 26th, and it certainly was a big night for Democrats who gathered to kick off the 2008 convention in Denver. And there are certainly lots of complicated issues on the table for them, chief among them creating unity to back the soon-to-be-officially nominated Barack Obama as their candidate for President of the United States. And to help tell his story, Michelle Obama made what many said would be a very important speech for herself last night, the first time many have heard her speak. It was her chance to help people learn more about her husband and their family. Ben Calhoun is a political reporter with Chicago Public Radio, and he's covering the convention, meaning he's there right in the middle of things in Denver. Ben, good morning. And what did Michelle Obama accomplish, do you think, in her speech?
Well, good morning, Adora. I think
Michelle Obama's speech had an interesting place in the night. You know, it was a night with some hard edges. You know, there was a lot of criticism of John McCain. There was sort of this hard critical edge to a lot of the speeches that we heard leading into hers. But her purpose, I thought, was a gentler one. She had something more personal to accomplish with her speech last night. And I think what that was that the campaign was looking for her to fill out her story. You know, in Chicago, she's well known and she's got this full biography, you know, as a professional woman, as a mother. She's a multidimensional person. And I think that, you know, last night, right off of the bat, including with how she was introduced by her brother, Craig, I think that we saw her sort of fill out her biography and really sort of try and flesh that out for people in a big way.
I come here as a mom whose girls are the heart of my heart and the center of my world. They're the first things I think about when I wake up in the morning and the last thing I think about before I go to bed at night. Their future and all our children's future is my stake in this election. And I come here as a daughter raised on the south side of Chicago.
And so I think that, you know, sort of what she was accomplishing with sections of the speech like that was she was making herself a more complete person and revealing, in a way, I think, a little bit about the role that the campaign looks for her to play for the next 70-some days.
And also another important goal for that speech, as many have explained, is how she would present her husband in perhaps a way that we don't necessarily know him, but a way that only she could speak to. And how did she do on that score?
Oh, you're absolutely right. I think that was, you know, goal number two, just on par with, you know, filling out her own story. And this is a role that we've seen her play throughout the campaign, you know, talking about, you know, his failure to put his socks in the hamper, or, you know, whatever it is around the house, and add that dimension to their biography and their lives together. And I think that we heard that again last night. And I think, the campaign probably thinks that it's important because on this front, the Obamas have been vulnerable to a certain amount of other people taking away their family story. You know, that's where I think we get covers like the cover that we saw on The New Yorker. I think that shows a little fluidity in sort of what can be done with their story as a couple. And then so last night, I think that, you know, she really, you know, took that platform that she created by fleshing out her own story and then tried to use that as a jumping off point to talk about her husband.
What struck me when I first met Barack was that even though he had this funny name, and even though he had grown up all the way across the continent in Hawaii, his family was so much like mine. He was raised by grandparents who were working class folks just like my parents, and by a single mother who struggled to pay the bills just like we did.
And then so in that bite that we heard right there, of course, she's not just filling out their biography together. She's also, you know, buttressing some of the themes that we're seeing emerge and be really emboldened in this convention.
So there you are in the convention hall listening to the speech and watching the audience. How did they react and what did people say afterwards about their feelings about what she had said, what she said?
Well, you know, it was interesting when I was watching sort of people in the hall and how they were taking everything in. It was sort of what you'd expect, very enthusiastic reception. So afterwards, I went to one of the stairwells, you know, one of the concrete stairwells in the Pepsi Center and waited for the crowds to sort of start flowing out after she was done. And so all these people are coming down the stairs and I started just grabbing people and asking them what they thought. And it was incredibly well received by every single person who stopped to take time with me. And what stuck out to them was exactly the things that we've been talking about, you know, the biographical information, her talking about being a mother, her talking about their relationship, fleshing out Barack Obama's biography in some ways that they were looking to hear from her. And all of those things were sort of what I kept hearing from people on their way out about what stuck out to them.
Okay, Ben, quickly tell us who's on the marquee headliner tonight, or who is the marquee headliner tonight?
Marquee headliner is, of course, Hillary Clinton, which is going to be a crucial speech here. There's a lot of people watching to see how she handles the message of converting her support over to the Obama camp, which, you know, there are some rifts that everybody is trying to put their fingers on, exactly how deep they go,
right,
you know, how they might impact this whole process.
Ben Calhoun, thank you. Ben is a reporter from Chicago Public Radio who is reporting for The Takeaway all week in Denver. And if you were watching Michelle Obama's speech last night, you might have noticed that in the crowd listening was Joe Biden, Barack Obama's newly chosen VP nominee. And for what Biden is up to in Denver, we turn now to Patrick Healy, reporting on the convention for our partner, The New York Times. Hey there, Patrick. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know? What has Biden been up to? We're talking now 3 days until he was publicly announced as the VP choice.
Yeah, well, he has been focusing on writing his speech for Wednesday night, his big night here at the convention. He's been sort of getting brought up to speed by Obama advisors on sort of the overall campaign strategy in terms of what they want him to do in the message that he's delivering and the attacks that he'll be making on John McCain. You know, sort of getting his sort of arms around this whole new role of his, you know, really sort of being in the spotlight. And then he arrived in Denver on Monday. He went for some barbecue here. He caused quite a stir. You know, there were delegates applauding. There were people in the street who were sort of saying, "Hey, Joe." And then he came into the convention hall as sort of the, you know, kind of the third celebrity, I'd say, I guess, of last night, you know, after Michelle Obama and Ted Kennedy. And you know, obviously, he was sort of one of the go-to cutaways for the television networks. I mean, either they were looking for, you know, people getting teary-eyed, you know, at Teddy's and Michelle's speeches, or they were cutting to Joe Biden, you know, sort of leading the applause, giving standing ovations when Ted Kennedy said, you know, "I want to be back in the Senate in January."
Right.
For universal
he was
healthcare.
Certainly among that crowd. But at the end of the day, obviously, his speech is going to be very important for him and what he means for the Barack Obama ticket. But his presence there this week is really more about this than the speeches, isn't it? I mean, he's now building a team, right, that he's going to go on the road with as he campaigns.
Right.
Any sense of who's going to be in that team?
Yeah, right now there's about, you know, four or five people who are his senior staff. They include a woman named Patty Solice Doyle, who was Hillary Clinton's campaign manager until last February when she was ousted. She's going to be Biden's chief of staff.
And do you know, do they have any prior history?
They don't. Not particularly. You know, the Obama campaign hired Patty and brought her in, you know, back sort of in the early summer. And then she was sort of in charge of putting together, you know, the team for the ultimate VP pick. But, you know, nobody knew at that point who it would be.
And so what do you think is going to be important for Joe Biden to do tomorrow night?
I think he's probably going to be the primetime speaker who will be making some slashing contrasts with John McCain. You know, last night in the primetime hour, you know, most television viewers were seeing, you know, particularly Michelle Obama, her brother Craig Robinson, they were getting sort of a feel for the Obama family. This was not a night when the Democrats were on the attack against John McCain. And there's been a great deal of talk that in 2004, the Democrats and John Kerry made a big mistake at their convention by not bringing the fight to George Bush enough. So I think you're going to see Biden really
bringing
be the
one fight.
In,
yes, yeah, we keep hearing that. Patrick Healy, many thanks.
Thank you.
Patrick Healy is a reporter for the New York Times, and he's coming to us from Denver at the Democratic National Convention.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's day two of the Democratic National Convention in Denver. And so we're thinking about undecided voters. Millions of voters still don't know who they plan to vote for, at least according to polls. And so we're thinking of giving them some advice. How do you make those tough decisions? How should they? Give us some decision-making wisdom at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
My name is Barbara Graves Toller, and I'm calling from Jersey City, New Jersey. I think the only way that you can truly be undecided at this point is if you're voting for the person that you'd rather hang out with instead of the person that you think should lead, the person in the party who you think should lead the country.
Huh. So if you're still undecided, is Barbara right? If you haven't decided, you know, give us a call and tell us why. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're also going to be taking a look at a bit of science today, trying to catch science in the act, so to speak. We're taking a look at a trend of research into how the brain works. The use of brain scanning technology has been growing as a tool to decode the inner workings of the mind. But some scientists fear that simplistic media hype is dramatically overstating findings and leading to some major misunderstandings. Scientists caution that one of these advancements, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI technology, may provide a window into the brain, but it doesn't provide concrete evidence about how the brain actually works. Jonah Lehrer is the author of Proust, was a neuroscientist. He's a science writer and the Takeaway science correspondent. And we're going to talk to him about the brain scan backlash in the scientific community. Good morning, Jonah.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So what kind of reports are scientists talking about that overplay exactly the latest developments?
Well, there are lots of them. Brain scanning technology is incredibly popular. There are about 8 brain scanning papers published every day. So some of this research is great, and a lot of it isn't so great. A lot of it relies on these very oversimplified assumptions about how the brain works.
Well, let's just talk about the basics. What is an fMRI?
Well, it's a huge machine. It takes up typically about a full room, and a patient is put into a small space. It's often described like a noisy coffin. And then they're told by the scientist to do the experimental task, and it can be looking at a picture or making a decision. And while they're doing this experimental task, the machine is monitoring blood flow in their brain, trying to detect these slightly different magnetic properties of blood with and without oxygen. And the basic assumption here is that increased brain activity requires increased blood flow. So changes in blood are used as a proxy to measure changes in neural activity. The problem, of course, is that that's an indirect measure. You don't think in blood. You think in bursts of electricity and neurotransmitter. And so this means that while fMRI is very good at measuring certain types of brain activity, it's very bad in measuring other types of brain activity. And so this technology that seems like a window into the soul, it seems like the black box of the brain has finally been broken open, it's actually not a window. Or if it is a window, the glass is very, very dirty.
Very dirty. I think we get that analogy. let me say that I've seen reports saying that scientists can potentially take an fMRI with all the detail that it provides and then tell us if an individual is going to, say, commit a crime. And clearly something like that would have serious potential consequences for public policy.
Yeah, it's not just committing a crime. It's can you tell if someone is lying? You know, there are lots of reports about how this technology can make lots of predictions about what people will do in the future or what they're thinking right now, you know, as if it can decode your soul. And while some of these experiments do have real validity to them, I think some of them are also very oversimplified. And I think one of the big misunderstandings about how this technology works is that it's not good at detecting neural connections. So when you try to localize very complex thoughts, like someone's violent tendencies or how they feel about their mother or Barack Obama, chances are many different brain regions all across the cortex are being activated. And so when you just try to reduce that complex activity to one specific brain region to say, here's the bit of cortex that's responsible for how you feel about Barack Obama, you know, you're often going to get a very misleading answer.
So it's fair to say that advancements have been made in understanding the brain, but there's still so much more to truly understand in terms of specifics.
Absolutely. You know, the brain is the most complex device in the known universe. And to simply believe that here this one bit of cortex is responsible for sarcasm or some complex emotion is without a doubt an oversimplification. The problem, of course, is that this technology is very good at localizing things. So chances are, no matter what question you ask it, it's going to come up with one specific brain area that seems to be more active. The important part to remember is that it's almost certain that the real story is much more complex, that this picture, which looks so simple, is actually very complicated statistics. As one science put it to me, the problem with fMRI is that the picture hides the sausage factory.
Another good one. Very quickly, last question. Backlash, this backlash in the scientific community, I mean, what does that look like and what would scientists like to see happen?
Well, there have been some very high-profile papers in big journals like Nature and Science, which have really criticized the overuse of fMRI. I think in the future what you're going to see is that scientists are using fMRI not by itself but in conjunction with other techniques so that you can kind of get past these inherent limitations in the technology.
Jonah, thanks so much. We're going to ask you to stick around. Jonah Lehrer is author of Proust, was a neuroscientist. He's a science writer and the Takeaways science correspondent. We're asking you, are you still undecided? Why? And how are you going to make that decision on who to vote for? Give us a call, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now we're going to get the latest headlines from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Thank you very much, Adoya. It is 28 minutes past the hour. A widely watched housing index shows home prices dropped by the sharpest rate ever in the second quarter this year. The Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller U.S. National Home Price Index fell almost 15.5%. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is condemning Russia's formal recognition today of South Ossetia and Abkhazia's independence. The Russian president announced that the official decree on national television today. Rice says the move will only serve to further alienate Russia from the West. The Democratic National Convention is in full swing in Denver this week. Michelle Obama delivered the event's keynote address last night, and ailing Senator Ted Kennedy made a surprise appearance on the stage to deliver his own speech. Hillary Clinton will give a much-anticipated talk on party unity tonight. And an extensive security barrier is around the Democratic Convention in Denver, but it hasn't stopped people from protesting. Denver authorities have been working through the night to process about 100 people arrested on minor disturbance charges close to the Democratic Convention. Authorities say that bonds have been set low enough that most people should be out pretty quickly. And Hurricane Gustave is headed for Haiti's capital city and gaining strength as it does so. Forecasters say the storm could make landfall later today, but by then it may well be a Category 2 hurricane with winds of almost 100 miles an hour. So I'm sure they are battening down the hatches and getting ready for that hurricane. Let's look at your news, Adora.
Yeah, that's like a second or third pounding so far this season.
Yeah, very unlucky.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. As we cover the Democratic Convention this week, we're thinking about undecided voters today. About 10% of voters still don't know who they are going to vote for come November, at least according to polls. And so we want you to give them some advice. How do you make those tough decisions? Give us a call, 8778-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Chances are you've caught a bit of Michelle Obama's speech from last night's Democratic Convention. The potential First Lady held the national spotlight, talking about herself, her husband, and their family, some hearing her for the very first time. What you might not know is that she was preceded by many, many speakers who took the podium in the 6 hours before she did. Many of you might have never heard their names, but Chicago Public Radio's Ben Calhoun is there at the convention, and he went to check it out. Ben, who was talking, and how long were they talking? And for many, it must have been a real highlight.
I have to say, I'm all about the big show as much as the next person. I love politics, but this is my favorite thing about yesterday is, you know, we kept getting these schedules of the speakers for the night, and it kept getting longer and longer and longer, and then we get this full schedule yesterday, and I'm looking at this enormous schedule of speakers between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m., and I figured, I did the math roughly, and I was like, everything is going to take on average 5 minutes. That's with any number of breaks and musical interludes, and so I was curious about some of these people that were going to have this huge platform, but for this itsy-bitsy little tiny window. It's kind of like, you know, minor league player being put in the major leagues, but just for one inning. So one of those people came up in the Illinois delegation breakfast, who's the state comptroller, Dan Hines. And Dan Hines is somebody who lost to Barack Obama in his Senate primary. And as far as Illinois politicians go, Dan Hines is a really nice guy. He's just a nice guy, kind of wears his heart on his sleeve, and he became, after this loss, a huge supporter of Barack Obama. So yesterday in the delegation breakfast, he said that he was going to have 2 minutes to make a speech. So I followed up with him afterwards and asked him about how he was preparing for this little tiny window.
It didn't seem very real until last night. I did a walkthrough and a rehearsal of the speech, and you walk on the stage, and it's clear that this isn't just any other speech. To any other audience. I mean, this is a national audience and a packed auditorium. But, when you're comfortable with the subject matter and you're passionate about it, I think you can overcome those nerves, and I think I'll be just fine.
Not only did he tell me that, but he told me that he had rehearsed for it, and he'd even tried to craft a joke that would fit into a two-minute speech.
Well, that's a tall order. Let me ask you this, though. 6 hours before prime time, how many people were there actually in the audience listening to Dan's and other people's speeches?
Yeah. I mean, that is sort of the other, you know, twist to all of this, is you've got this huge list of speakers who have this big moment, this big platform, still the tiny little window, but then the convention hall is filled with people who are trading buttons, they're chattering, they're, you know, talking with any number of people, doing a lot of things other than paying attention to this person who has, you know, maybe rehearsed, put a lot of thought into how they're going to get the most bang that they can out of this 2 minutes. I have a bite here from Dan's speech when he actually came up. So he comes up, and I was waiting for him for his. He talked about his joke. He had all these plans, and so this was what he said.
My name is Dan Hines, and I'm the Illinois State Comptroller. 4 years ago, I ran in the Democratic primary in Illinois for the U.S. Senate. I had a few advantages, but I lacked the most important one of all. I wasn't Barack Obama. I remember thinking he was the most gifted person I'd seen in public life, visionary and practical. In debates, his knowledge seemed to come not just from his head, but from his heart.
So that was about 25 seconds, and really that was what essentially was a third of what ended up being Dan Hines' moment in the sun last night.
And you can certainly hear the hum of people behind him. They didn't crack a joke, or they didn't clap when he took to the podium. I mean, was it just a thrill for him of being on the stage, or did he get any reaction at all for the words that he spoke?
Yeah, you know, he got some love. He got some love from the Illinois delegation, which was up front, and they all made sure to be there. It was there was a series of Illinois speakers, so they came out to support. But so afterwards, after all the speeches of the night, I wanted to find out whether or not all of his rehearsal, all of his practice, his one-liner there, whether that had connected with anybody. So when I was in the stairwell that we talked about earlier, getting reaction to Michelle Obama's speech, I decided to just, you know, ask people also what they thought of Dan Hines' speech. And this was Ray Reif, who was from Greensburg, North Carolina.
What did you think of Dan Hines' speech?
Dan Hines' speech. I don't know that I saw that one, to be honest with you.
He was pretty early on.
Yeah, I didn't see all the speeches, so I might have missed that one.
I stayed in that stairwell until the flow of people, slowed to a trickle. I mean, the place was pretty much empty. There was like one person after another every few, 10 seconds, 25 seconds. But that was throughout everybody I asked, I found nobody that remembered Illinois Comptroller Dan Hines' minute.
But he wasn't the only one who spoke in that 6-hour period. You want to give us a sense of who else was up there on the stage? And I would assume treated pretty similarly.
Yeah, I've got a 4.5-page list right in front of me right here. I won't read all of them to you, but we've got, the Attorney General from Illinois. We've got the treasurer from Illinois. We've got labor leaders. We've got the president of the National Education Association. It's just like it goes on and on.
And other people from across the country, I would assume, also.
Oh,
no,
absolutely.
Or yes?
Yeah, we've got Nancy Pelosi got a little more time when she spoke. She spoke earlier in the day, as you can imagine. But the people like the Democratic Party treasurer didn't get a ton of time.
Didn't get a ton of time, but at least he was up there. Ben Calhoun is a Chicago Public Radio political reporter, and he's in Denver reporting for The Takeaway. And now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who's got a few headlines for us. Femi?
Thank you very much, Adora. Coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in the West Bank for talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, and she's responding to Russia's announcement that it will formally recognize two breakaway provinces in the Republic of Georgia. Rice called Russia's move regrettable. Thousands of anti-government protesters are on the streets of Bangkok demanding the resignation of the Thai Prime Minister and his government. The demonstrations have been organised by critics of the former Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawat. Afghan President Hamid Karzai wants to know why US and NATO airstrikes are killing so many civilians in Afghanistan. His government will review the presence of US and NATO troops in the country. And the New York Giants are trying to entice Michael Strahan out of retirement. The Giants have contacted the 7-time Pro Bowl defensive end to see if he's interested in ending his brief retirement. He's already signed on as a TV sports analyst. And he's probably...
Oh, yeah, he's going to give up that job so that he can go back to working hard in the field.
He's currently on holiday in Greece, and people are talking about $8 million maybe to get him out of retirement.
He's going to rush back from vacation on Greece to hit the field. Yeah, I see that happening.
It could be.
Okay, thanks, Femi.
Maybe.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji. John Hockenberry is away. As we cover the Democratic convention that began yesterday in Denver, we noted that the speeches went late into the night. So we're bringing you highlights from the prime time coming out of the potential First Lady, Michelle Obama. She spoke for about 20 minutes in front of a packed crowd at the convention hall. Many said her mission was to share the Barack Obama she knows, a softer side, the family man side. But it was also an opportunity to tell a bit of her story and their story as a family.
In my own life, in my own small way, I've tried to give back to this country that has given me so much. See, that's why I left a job at a big law firm for a career in public service, working to empower young people to volunteer in their communities, because I believe that each of us, no matter what our age or our background or our walk in life, each of us has something to contribute to the life of this nation. And it's a belief that Barack shares, a belief at the heart of his life's work. See, it's what he did all those years ago in Chicago, setting up job training to get people back to work and after-school programs to keep kids safe, working block by block to help people lift up their families.
And much like her husband, she spoke about change.
All of us driven by the simple belief that the world as it is just won't do. That we have an obligation to fight for the world as it should be. And that is the thread that connects our hearts. That is the thread that runs through my journey and Barack's journey and so many other improbable journeys that have brought us here tonight, where the current of history meets this new tide of hope. And you see, that is why I love this country.
Michelle Obama shared stories only she could about the Barack Obama that she's seen that no one else has.
He's the same man who drove me and our new baby daughter home from the hospital 10 years ago this summer, inching along at a snail's pace, peering at us anxiously through the rearview mirror, feeling the whole weight of her future in his hands, determined to give her everything he struggled so hard for himself, determined to give her something he never had, the affirming embrace of a father's love. And as I tucked that little girl in, and her little sister into bed at night, you see, I think about how one day they'll have families of their own, and how one day they and your sons and daughters will tell their own children about what we did together in this election. They'll tell them how this time we listened to our hopes instead of our fears. How this time we decided to stop doubting and to start dreaming. How this time, in this great country where a girl from the south side of Chicago can go to college and law school, and the son of a single mother from Hawaii can go all the way to the White House.
That was Michelle Obama speaking at the opening of the Democratic National Convention last night in Denver.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We have some headlines for you from Femi OK. Hey, Femi.
Thank you, Adora. Hello there. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev says that Russia has formally recognized the independence of the Republic of Georgia's breakaway provinces of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in the Middle East, where she will meet with Israeli and Palestinian leaders today. Rice is in the region as part of a U.S. effort to secure a peace deal by the end of this year. The Democratic National Convention kicked off with speeches from Michelle Obama and Senator Ted Kennedy. But Hillary Clinton, all eyes will be on her tonight when she takes to the stage. John McCain has a new ad out using her words against Barack Obama. In it, Clinton is shown saying that she knows that Senator McCain, and I quote, has a lifetime of experience, while Obama has, and I quote, a speech he gave in 2002. And while everybody was very pleased to see Senator Ted Kennedy, and the audience were crying and they got to their feet last night, and there was the former President Jimmy Carter there, two little girls stole the show. Have a listen to this.
Daddy, what city are you in?
I'm in Kansas City, sweetie. Malia, Sasha, how do you think Mom did?
I think she did good.
I think so, too. Well, listen, I want you guys to look after the girls. Look after Mommy before I get there, and I'll see you guys on Thursday, all right?
I love you, Daddy.
Love you guys.
That's Malia and Sasha Obama at the Democratic National Convention last night. And that's a look at your news.
Thanks very much, Femi. And we're thinking about undecided voters today. 10% of voters still don't know who they're going to vote for, according to polls. So we want you to give them some advice. How do you make these tough decisions? 8778-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Just want to remind folks, Jonah Lehrer, author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist and The Takeaway Science Correspondent, is still with us because, again, we're talking about undecided voters because it turns out they actually know who they want to vote for. They just don't know that they know, or so says a recent study carried out by Italian and Canadian psychologists. The study found that many people who think they are undecided really have already made up their decision. They just might not be aware of it. More importantly, their decisions are derived not necessarily from facts, but from their personal preferences they didn't realize they even had. Dr. Bertram Goransky is an author of the study. Good morning, doctor. So what do you know that you didn't know you knew this morning? Had to ask.
What we do know is, and we all know this for quite a while, is that people tend to have automatic associations with regard to a variety of objects in their environment, among those being politicians. And what we found was that these automatic associations, even if they don't really crystallize themselves into a conscious decision at a particular point, that these automatic associations can bias people's perceptions of ambiguous information. So if you, for example, take a political debate between two candidates, that this can distort their perception of the political debate so that they come to a particular conclusion. And so in that sense, these automatic associations can lead them into a particular direction. And that enabled us to predict future choices of undecided decision makers in this study, or if you apply it to the political process, one could say that automatic associations could predict which candidate someone would sway to, even at a point where participants haven't made a conscious decision yet.
But how do you parse out that information?
So what we do is we use computer-based speed of categorization tasks. So in our study, this was about a controversial expansion of a U.S. military base in Italy. And we present them, or in this particular study, we presented them with positive and negative words on a computer screen. And participants were asked to categorize these words as positive and negative as quickly as possible. And randomly interspersed with these positive and negative words, we've shown them pictures of the U.S. military base. And in one condition of the task, they were asked to press the same key that they use for positive words every time they see a picture of the military base. In another condition, we asked them to press the same key that they use for negative words that they, every time they see a picture of the military base. And automatic associations influence people's performance in the task in the sense that someone with more favorable associations regarding the U.S. military base in our study, for them, it would be easier.
But how do you account for any predisposition? I mean, you're picking something pretty controversial in many parts of the world as the U.S. military. It's unlikely that any adult is going to sit there with no opinion about it before they begin this study.
Oh, yeah, sure. What we did, we asked them in a first step whether they were in favor the enlargement, against the enlargement, or if they're still undecided. We asked them quite a number of questions about their conscious beliefs, what the expansion of the U.S. military base will do to the region economically, environmentally, socially. And we gave them this computer-based task to identify their automatic association.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to hold on right there because I want to bring Jonah Lehrer into the conversation. He is a science writer and the Takeaway's science correspondent. And Jonah, what's your thought on this, that we know but we don't really realize that we know?
Well, the point of this clever study backs up a lot of research showing that consciousness is a very small part of what the brain is doing at any given moment, and most of your decisions are strongly influenced by all that stuff taking place in your unconscious, which generates all these subtle emotions which then guide your actual behavior. So this research, I think, extends a lot of this previous research to the domain of politics and showing that undecided voters, even though they may consciously think they haven't made a decision, their unconscious shows otherwise. And by asking people questions that can tap into their unconscious, you can really access all those decisions that are taking place there.
Dr. Gorinsky, given what you've found, how do you think that political parties, one side or the other, can use this to help their causes?
Well, I think, and this is a little bit the unfortunate side of this finding, I think they, to some degree, they already have realized that, because if you look at how certain campaigns are running right now, that it's sometimes it's like the messages are much more subtle. It's less about content. And this is how these automatic associations are created. So you can describe this more in a fashion like conditioning processes. So we've all heard about the dog. The bell is ringing when the food is coming, and at some point, just the bell leads to the same response. And you can compare that to that situation. You repeatedly pair something with something positive or something negative. So there is not really an argument here. So this is the way how these automatic associations develop. And I think this is actually the scary part of the message here, that undecided voters may be particularly susceptible to these type of campaigning.
Jonah, so are we being manipulated, or at least those who are undecided or seemingly undecided, are they being manipulated by the campaigns?
This is just what advertisers do. It's the same thing. That's why beer advertisers pair their brand with pretty blonde models on a beach. They want to generate those positive associations, and now politicians are doing the exact same tactic.
And, Doctor, what other conclusions did you make in your study?
One thing that we also found, and I think this is a part that is often ignored, is that this primarily works only for undecided voters. For decided voters, we find completely the opposite. For them, it's primarily what they consciously believe, but automatic associations don't have any influence at all. It's exactly to the contrary. Their conscious beliefs influence their automatic associations. So I think here's a little bit also the potential for future research that we could then give people if they don't want to be influenced by their automatic associations, because it seems like that decided voters are doing something that influences their automatic associations. So if you don't want to become a slave of your automatic mental associations, there seem to be means to make yourself resistant against that.
So we can fight back, Dr. Bertram.
Exactly.
Goransky.
I hope so.
Thank you very much. He's Associate Professor of Social Psychology at the University of Western Ontario. And Jonah Lehrer, I'm going to give you the last word. How do we fight back?
I think you fight back, as the professor said, by trying to learn about these candidates, by trying to fill your conscious brain with all sorts of facts and knowledge about their actual policies. You can actually make yourself a little bit more rational. You can fight back against the way your brain is actually designed.
Fighting back. Thanks, Jonah Lehrer. He's the author of Proust Was a Neuroscience. He's a science writer and the Takeaways science correspondent. Always glad to see him. And we're talking about undecided voters. And here's DJ from New Jersey.
I'm undecided because while I've usually voted Democratic in the past because of their platforms, I buy results, not promises. And John McCain has a proven record of always reaching out to the other side, of sponsoring many bills with Democrats, of actually hurting his own political career by some of the choices he has made. That's my big indecision here.
Well, there you go. What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's today's takeaway.
You can actually make yourself a little bit more rational. You can fight back against the way your brain is actually designed.
That's Takeaway Science correspondent Jonah Lehrer talking about fighting back. I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.